It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Megan Harris, in for Kevin Gavin. Pittsburghers are no strangers to self-driving cars. While an operator is in the driver's seat for now, a few companies are working here locally to create a future where driving is a choice, not a necessity. I spoke recently with the CEO of one of those companies, Brian Selesky. He heads Argo AI in the Strip District.
You're trying to create automated driving systems for Ford and Volkswagen that can be used for ride sharing or fleet delivery, especially in dense urban areas.
Right.
Why is Argo AI focused on that specific mission, as opposed to maybe building a fully autonomous car for individual consumers?
Right, it's a good question. So the cost of the technology that goes onto the car to make it completely self-driving without any human intervention needed is quite expensive. And so as a result, it's difficult to expect a typical consumer to be able to afford that when they go to purchase a vehicle. So a better business case is actually to sell rides and then spread the cost of that equipment over the lifetime of the car. And then that feeds into a larger transformative piece that once you've unlocked that, now you can imagine that if you're in a city, you don't even necessarily need to own a car. You can just get a ride when you need it, and then you don't have to worry about paying taxes, fueling it, and so on.
With the cars themselves, there are 6 levels of automation for vehicles, 0 to 5. Last I read, Argo AI is developing and testing a level 4 vehicle. For the layperson, describe what that means.
Right. So level 4 means that the vehicle can drive on specific streets that we designate without any involvement of a human driver. So no one needs to monitor the vehicle. It can drive autonomously from A to B on those specific streets.
How long or how much more development do you imagine it would take to get to that level 5?
Well, so level 5 means that you can drive anywhere. I think that's going to be decades away.
Is that the dream, though?
I think that's the dream. But to be clear, we don't want to take away people's right to drive. If you enjoy driving, you should have the opportunity to drive, in our view. We just don't think that people want to drive necessarily in these dense urban areas where there's a lot of congestion and it's very taxing mentally to drive. We think people want to drive on like the quintessential road trip or a weekend drive to clear your head,
yeah,
that type of thing.
How do you teach the vehicles and work with your engineers to deal with all the little local idiosyncrasies, whether it's like a Pittsburgh left or I've heard tell of pedestrians in Miami who don't pay any attention to what the rules are supposed to be? How do you deal with all of that humanity?
Yeah, and humanity isn't going to change just because we have self-driving cars on the road, right? Our engineers embrace the challenge. They love it. So not to encourage anyone to jaywalk, but when it happens, you know, we're able to take that data back and really use it to test our algorithms and make them better. So we embrace the challenge in Pittsburgh and every other city that we're testing in.
This summer, you forged a partnership with Volkswagen, got a couple of billion out of that. It brought your valuation to $7 billion. That easily puts you among some of the most valued startups in Pittsburgh. Do you think that this is a good place for startups to call home?
I think Pittsburgh is a wonderful place to call home. And we've actually seen a lot of people relocate and be excited to come to Pittsburgh. The city sells itself at this point. People love the cost of living. They love how nice people are here. They love the sports environment and everything else that it has to offer.
Argo AI has used the strategy of finding a manufacturer to directly partner rather than seeking a number of private investors like some of your counterparts. Why was it important to you to partner directly with manufacturers like Ford and Volkswagen?
Right. So Ford and Volkswagen are two of the largest global automakers. So they know how to produce a huge variety of types of vehicles. So it's great to have them aligned around our platform because it means that we can take the self-driving system and put it on all sorts of vehicles and get it into markets worldwide. So they really help us scale out the system. They help us manufacture it and get it produced at scale. They know how to put together, obviously, a very complex consumer product that is the automobile today. We can learn a lot from their methods and processes that they've learned over the years. So it's been just a great partnership. And of course, we know how to build software, really complex software. And so we complement them in that regard. And together, it's been a great partnership.
I want to go back to what you were talking about as far as company growth. Is it fair to say that you're in a bit of a hiring frenzy? 3 dozen employees a couple years ago, more than 250, I think, now?
So we're actually approaching 300 now in Pittsburgh.
Yeah.
And then across the U.S. we're at about 540 people. And thankfully, we now have the capital, right, to continue to grow thanks to the VW investment. Ford's been a great partner. And together, you know, we're real serious about making this happen.
One job that stuck out to us here at the Confluence, I understand you're in the process of hiring a state and local government affairs officer. What will that person do for Argo?
Well, it's important that we work really well with the cities that we're serving eventually, right? The cities that we launch in eventually, I mean. And so it's important that we have people on the ground who are able to explain the technology, how it works, how we test, manage expectations in terms of timelines. And so that person's going to work with local policymakers to make sure they understand Argo and what we're all about.
Do you think that Washington, Harrisburg, Pittsburgh understand Argo right now?
Well, I know that we have been reaching out in order to make sure that they do. So we've had opportunities and have talked to NHTSA, which is at the federal level that regulates traffic safety in the United States. We've had Mayor Peduto in the car, and we've explained to him and his staff and Karina Ricks kind of what we're all about. We've let them experience the vehicle. We've also invited first responders in to see and to socialize how it works and what we would expect if there is a collision or an event, like how you are able to safe the vehicle and things like that.
How do you feel lawmakers are doing when it comes to regulating technology like yours? Do you think that they're keeping up?
Well, I think they're in a listen and learn phase, and my hope is that we can eventually get to a point where we can get a unified framework of legislation for AVs across the country. I think that's where we would all like to see it go. But we realize that someone told me recently that all good things happen locally or begin locally, mm-hmm. right? So we recognize we also need to work on that front.
What regulations do you think would allow Argo AI to thrive but still be responsible to the public?
There's going to be some sort of transparency on all companies that are working in this field. And so working with the policymakers and local constituents to understand what do they want to know about Argo, what do they want to know about our operation, what are some of the assurances that we can give them in terms of the fact that it is safe and that it is doing good things for the community. We're open to all of those types of conversations, and I think that's a positive way to have these kind of discussions.
And of course, all of your AVs have to remain connected to some kind of network. How do you protect it from being hacked?
Well, that's a good question. We actually have a wonderful cybersecurity professional that we hired from the SEI at CMU. She worked as part of what's called CERT, which is a nationally recognized lab for cybersecurity. And she has built a fantastic team that is putting in place a number of defense mechanisms to prevent hacking and doing what's called penetration testing. So we've actually hired firms that will come in and throw the state of the art at the vehicle to see if they could break in. And if they can, then we learn from those sorts of experiences and we then improve the system. So it's a combination of getting the right experts and doing the right testing.
Where do you feel like you are in that process right now?
Well, our last test was super successful, so they weren't able to get in. So I'm super happy about that. But the system is constantly developing and evolving, right? So it's a thing where continuous testing is really important.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Megan Harris, and we're at the headquarters of Argo AI in the Strip District. Our guest is CEO Brian Selesky. Brian, I saw you write recently that one of your biggest hurdles has nothing to do with the tech itself, that society must be ready to accept autonomous vehicles. What do you mean by that? What things are difficult for society to take on?
Well, I think when we talk to people in cities today, they just want to know, is it safe and are you going to help us? Or are you just adding more cars on the road that takes up more pavement?
Mm-hmm.
And so when I tell the story about the fact that someday you won't have to have that take the keys conversation away with from your parents or grandmother, people start to switch on to this pretty quickly. It's the ability to provide a method of personal or private transportation and provide a great experience to people without them having to own a car. I think there's a lot of misinformation in the field right now about autonomous vehicles. I think people don't know what to make of them and don't know why they're on the streets. And so you know, we need to do a better job of telling these stories. And we in fact had a guest recently who'd never been in a self-driving car before. She was actually quite nervous before she got into the car, and she didn't tell me this until after the fact, of course. But she got into the back seat, and she said within the first couple of minutes she immediately got it. And it's amazing how people just in a few minutes have seen how well it operates, and they notice very subtle things like, oh, it moved over for a person who was getting out of their car that was, you know, parked on the side of the road, or it nudged over to give a large vehicle more room. It's those subtle things that maybe your Uber or Lyft driver didn't do mm-hmm. that adds up to, oh, wow, this is actually, it's way more perceptive and it's always paying attention. It starts to really drive home when you experience it. So, you know, I've seen this over and over again. You get people who are not quite sure they experience it, and then they're immediately big fans. So, you know, we're gonna have to find a way to continue to do that sort of education.
What will you need to see in terms of local infrastructure to make fully autonomous cars a reality in urban centers, especially like downtown Pittsburgh?
So we're actually in downtown Pittsburgh today. We don't think we need any infrastructure, special infrastructure to operate safely. The whole system is designed to be self-contained.
So even
And work as we are right now. And that's because we know that it's a huge investment to upgrade infrastructure, and these are things that are only going to happen over a long period of time. So we're patient about that. I will say that smart infrastructure, if you want to call it that, is really important. And the more that those things come online, they become additional sensors for our system, and it gives us more information, which just makes the system that much safer and that much more reliable.
Do you think that cities should be keeping in mind technology like yours for the future as they're making changes to their infrastructure 20 years in the future, 50 years in the future?
Yeah, I absolutely think they should. And, you know, it isn't going to be just one thing, though, I want to say. It isn't just going to be self-driving cars. It's also going to be these connected systems and if you want to call it an operating system, if you will, that will have to manage congestion through cities, right? So as these, one of the biggest advantages of a self-driving car, in addition to all the other things we've talked about, is that if we do connect it to smart infrastructure, you know, we can work together with that quote-unquote operating system to say, hey, you know what, take this route instead of this other one to avoid creating a big backlog of congestion where there's construction or where some sort of roadside event occurred, and we can give people more room by taking a slightly different route. Human drivers, you can give them suggestions on those sorts of things, but they don't always, I know better. I'm going to find my way through,
exactly.
Right? So I think there's ways to, I think that you have to, any city planner that's looking to the future has to think about this as a giant connected system. There's no one single technology that's going to fix the things that we face.
Do you think that it's truly a race to have the first fully autonomous vehicle? And if there is a race, is Pittsburgh on the finish line?
Well, I don't think there's a race at all. My view is that there's something around 3 trillion miles driven in the U.S. alone. The large percentage of that is actually passenger miles. And I think the different companies that are working on autonomous technology are going after different miles. Some are working in suburbs. Some are more in the urban centers like we are. Others are focused on trucking. And that's a good thing for the economy. We want to look at making that full space of, the miles that are driven safer. You know, I think that the problem is so huge and it's so vast, the opportunity, that it's less of a race.
How far off is it?
Well, I think you're going to see small fleets of shared autonomous vehicles in some sort of ride-hailing context in the next few years. And I think that it'll be in select cities. It'll be probably, specific sections of a city where we can help the transportation systems that are there. And then you'll start to see those fleets eventually sort of grow and ramp up. But it will scale out relatively slowly as, we need to give the communities and cities a chance to understand what we're doing. And again, it goes back to that acceptance thing.
I want to go back very quickly to some of those infrastructure challenges you were talking about. I understand you're in the early stages of some of that development, especially with some of the local universities.
We are. So we work with Carnegie Mellon on a number of different initiatives. They are helping us with with researching what a next generation self-driving system might look like. There's also a number of different spin-outs from CMU that are working on smart traffic infrastructure that have already had a meaningful impact on the throughput and sort of timing of the traffic lights in different sections, like the East Liberty corridor. Mm-hmm. And we've worked with one of those companies and have connected sort of the state of the intersection to our vehicle to make it safer.
Do you think that Pittsburgh has, I guess, how important is that education component working with the universities in different cities across the country?
Well, I think it's super important. This is such a new technology, and a lot of people don't know what to make of it necessarily. That we have to continually be on the circuit to make sure people understand.
So much of the work with Argo is being done here in Pittsburgh. Do you expect the rollout of your first fully autonomous vehicle to be here or somewhere else?
Well, we haven't announced any of that yet.
But it's coming.
Well, we're in the test and development phase, and so Pittsburgh is an important part of that. As far as how it goes to market and which cities are first and second and that sort of thing is totally being discussed, and we don't have anything to announce there just yet.
Last question. What is Brian Zaleski's view for the future, at least in terms of Argo and AVs?
What I hope to see is that our first few deployments in the cities that we do launch a commercial service in, I hope that we show and are able to demonstrate that this is a safer way to move around, that that we're able to offer mobility, personal mobility, to people who don't have it today, that have various, you know, accessibility needs. And I hope that we're able to plug the holes in transportation systems that are not working well in cities.
Brian Zaleski is the CEO of Argo AI. Brian, thanks for taking time.
Thank you very much.
I'm Megan Harris. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
The Confluence airs weekday mornings from 9 to 10, but the news never stops. Find stories, conversations, and full episodes on our website at wesa.fm/confluence, on Twitter at WESAConfluence, and wherever you get your podcasts. The Confluence continues next on 90.5 WESA.
We met God this week in 1999, but she didn't have a whole lot to say. Kevin Smith's film Dogma, which was shot in Pittsburgh, told the story of two fallen angels trying to get back to heaven. Along the way, they met a celestial cast of characters from lovable stoners to despicable demons. The role of God was played by singer Alanis Morissette, and to clarify, wasn't that she didn't have a lot to say, but that the sound of her voice would basically shatter all of existence. Luckily, Morissette's real voice is much less destructive than God's, and she recorded a song called Still for the film. For 91.3 WYEP, I'm Joey Spehar.
It is The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Megan Harris, in for Kevin Gavin. Last week, the Pittsburgh Planning Commission approved the Greater Hazelwood Neighborhood Plan after a couple years in the works. Here to discuss it, plus updates on grants through the Housing and Urban Development Department, the downtown sinkhole, and more, is Margaret J. Krause, WESA's development and transportation reporter. Margaret, good morning.
Good morning.
So the Hazelwood Neighborhood Plan, remind us, what is it and where did it come from?
Sure. It is one of the city's first few neighborhood plans. It's called the Our Hands, Our Plans plan. And it really was a community-driven effort to say Hazelwood is facing lots of investment in the future because of Hazelwood Green coming mm-hmm. online. Let's make sure we're prepared to ensure that our community doesn't just get hit by this wave of investment, but instead can use it to leverage what we want to see.
For our listeners, the green makes up about one-fifth of the official neighborhood. It's along the riverfront and has been poised for a long time for a development that hasn't really materialized yet.
Well, it was for more than a century a steelmaking works, and right. So the soil was not ready. You know, all that soil had to be remediated. The site had to be graded. They had to put in all the stuff, electricity and gas lines and water lines. So they are finally ready to do quote-unquote vertical development, so to build stuff that does things.
Right. So how much did residents have for this initial planning phase?
Over 2 years, they had a lot of meetings, and there were very involved steering committees that would focus on something like economic development or transportation or health or the parks. So it was really hearing neighborhoods talk about the process, it sounded very engaged. I went to a few meetings and they were always packed, like more than 150 people.
You quoted someone who said, "We know that you can't stop development and you can't stop the market. The best you can do is guide it," end quote. How did residents interact with this planning phase in the meetings that you attended?
There was a lot of emphasis on we want to develop without displacement. Hazelwood for a long time was a booming place, a diverse place, but when Steele fell apart, Hazelwood lost a lot of people. And so there is this relatively low density, few people, there's a lot of green space, and then there is this huge 178-acre future development that could happen. And so they have talked about how they want investment because they want things in their communities. They want stores and shops and restaurants and jobs. And to have that, you need investment. But they want to make sure that future investment knows what they want.
So few people, but very important people. How are they going to accomplish these goals without displacing those residents?
I think a lot of it, I've been thinking about it like an ocean wave. You know, if you build a really strong berm, it's not going to knock down the berm. If you just build a sand wall, it's going to erode it. So there's a lot of emphasis. The implementation part of the plan is very long, and it has this matrix. It goes on for a while. A lot of it is preparation. So how do they make sure that they're investing in people and their skills, people and their homes, helping people stay in their homes? So developing a base of strength to make sure that they can take advantage of investment.
Is there a timetable? What might come first?
Well, a lot of things are ongoing. Things like promoting and supporting entrepreneurship, you know, like creating a neighborhood training and employment hub. That's a 5 to 10 year effort. So they're marked out on 0 to 2 years, 3 to 5, 5 to 10, and ongoing.
Margaret, let's switch gears a little. I understand you have updates on both the sinkhole that opened up beneath a bus downtown last month, as well as the train that derailed Friday in Hempfield Township. The derailment first. Has service through that area been restored?
Yeah, so it is a busy both freight and passenger corridor. By Sunday, 25 freight trains had rolled through the area.
And do we know any more about damage estimates?
No, Norfolk Southern, they're going to still be pulling up everything that derailed and scrapping it and getting rid of it. That's going to be ongoing. I'm not entirely sure for how long.
And the sinkhole, for those who haven't been downtown, the hole is still there. What's happened so far and what's happening next?
Very much still there. There has been a daily conference call with all the utilities who are affected by the sinkhole, and they've been coordinating work, you know, who's working on what and where and when. And now they're working on who pays for what and when. And they're still not sure what caused the sinkhole. There were a couple of water lines, a separated storm sewer, and a service line that was not in service, actually, that were affected by the sinkhole that may have played a role. But apparently no one is pointing fingers. They're trying to figure out what happened.
Lots we still don't know there.
Yeah, a lot. It actually may never know, because when a bus drops on your infrastructure, who knows when the damage happened, before or because of the drop? It's unclear.
Is there any way that this could have had anything to do with mine subsidence, which, of course, is a question for lots of homes and residential areas around the city?
It is. Mine subsidence is a big deal in our area, but so far there's no indication that this was at all related to mine subsidence.
Gotcha. Before you go, Margaret, Pittsburgh residents can have their voices heard on how to use requested funding from the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. The first public meeting is this evening at 6 o'clock. That's at CCA's Northside campus. How much money is the city asking for, and what types of programs are on the docket?
So there is always more need than money when it comes to asking the federal government for programs. So I'm not sure how much money they will end up asking for. But some of the programs are the community development block grants, which can be used in a number of ways, home investment partnerships, emergency solution grants, and housing opportunities for persons with AIDS.
If you miss this first meeting, there's going to be several more. We'll have a link to that calendar on our website, WESA.FM. Margaret, for those who want to, whether it's in person or online, how can residents contribute their thoughts, at least for now?
So that is important to note. There is an online survey. It's basically to help the city understand what's happening in your neighborhood. What are you seeing? What are the impediments to people accessing housing? Are there any discrimination acts going on when it comes to housing? What kind of housing and rental problems are there? As well as, do you see problems with your park, etc.? So basically just helping the city understand what's happening on the very micro level.
We'll have to leave it there. Margaret J. Krause is WESA's development and transportation reporter. Margaret, thanks so much.
Thank you, Megan.
I'm Megan Harris. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Megan Harris in for Kevin Gavin. A couple times a year, dozens of former armed service members in matching Pittsburgh tees file onto a charter bus well before the sun rises. They served in conflicts during World War II, in Korea and Vietnam, and for one day in our nation's capital, they're accorded the proper salute many may have missed when returning home decades ago. Honor Flight Pittsburgh just completed its seventh trip. Joining the Confluence to talk about the organization and the free trips it provides are Beth Rushell, fundraising chair on Honor Flight's local board of directors. Welcome, Beth.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here.
Bob Kunkel is a former board member and veteran of the Marine Corps during Vietnam. He later served in the Army National Guard. Bob, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Megan.
We're also joined by two of this year's participants. Isla Cole was just 20 years old when she was accepted into the Navy WAVES program in 1945. She served a little over 2 years and was in San Francisco when World War II ended later that year. Isla, thanks for coming.
I'm pleased to be here.
And Vicki Hyduke served with the Women's Army Corps from 1968 to 1970. She was on active duty with the Army National Guard through 2005 and retired that year as a Chief Warrant Officer 4. Vicki, thanks so much for coming down.
I'm glad you invited me.
Let's start with an easy one, guys. Beth, Bob, what is Honor Flight?
Honor Flight is a national organization that has over 130 hubs throughout the country. It was established in 2005. The World War II memorial was just completed that year, and the purpose of Honor Flight was to get World War II veterans to that memorial. They took a group, they chartered their own planes, or they used their own planes and took people, and I think there were 12 people that they took. From there, things branched out. It's called Honor Flight because they actually fly people,
in
veterans.
Some cities, and in Pittsburgh, it's more of a bus trip.
Right, yes. It's only a four-hour trip, so we bus down. Just a great organization, and Beth, I'll let you add a little bit more.
Yeah, Beth, when did it get started here locally?
We got started here in 2016.
October 2016, yeah.
Yes, so typically we do two trips a year, one in the spring, one in the fall. It was decided because so many people have already signed up for this coming year that we're actually going to be doing three trips. So it's exciting to me that more veterans are learning about Honor Flight in Pittsburgh. When I got involved, I actually, flipping channels one night, found a movie, and it's the Honor Flight movie that was a documentary made by a group, the Stars and Stripes group out of Wisconsin. And after I watched that movie, it was probably 2 a.m, and I immediately said, I have to do this. Because it was just so amazing to me what they were doing. So I found the Pittsburgh group, and I've been involved since then. I was shocked that more people in Pittsburgh didn't know about it. So this past summer, I took a couple months to kind of go everywhere I could, grocery stores, parks, VFWs, Legions, and pass out as many flowers as I could.
So participants who want to be involved, they apply, they're accepted. They meet the morning of the excursion. Again, still dark outside, lots of sleepy faces outside those charter buses in Wexford. Beth, then what happens? Walk us through the day.
Well, we all meet up at a church in Wexford, and it's important to know that this is a free trip to the veterans. There's no cost to the veterans. The veterans are accompanied by a guardian, who the guardian does pay to go on the trip. That's $200. We leave Wexford at about 5 a.m.
Yep.
And travel to D.C. Now, the wonderful thing about getting to D.C. is that we have a police escort throughout the day, which if you've been to D.C., you know that that's awesome because you get to go through all the traffic lights. You get to go through all the traffic. You get to park up front at all the memorials.
I think that's one of the most fun things of the trip is watching the park police operate, banging cars to pull over and the sirens and people just watching us go by. It's just really fun watching everybody see that and how they do their thing. It's pretty cool.
Vicki, what was that like for you as a participant on the trip to see, you know, be able to kind of make the C's part, so to speak?
Well, I ended up talking to our police escort, and I says, boy, you have a tough job. And he kind of laughed and says, yeah, well, somebody has to do it. So it was great, the fact that no matter where we went, we didn't have to wait at all. We got right there and got right to the different monuments and the different places that they had scheduled for us. So it was nice to have the escort.
Absolutely.
Isla, what was your favorite part of the experience? You got to see lots of memorials, of course. What did it mean to you?
Well, I had been there before, but this was really special. And I had the guardian, Beth, and we really enjoyed each other. And she helped me, and I didn't need a lot of help.
She doesn't want help.
But the trip with this policeman with the sirens, that was fun watching the people, like you said.
Beth, yeah. That guardian program is kind of unique. Will you explain that? You know, the two of you got to develop a bit of a relationship over the day.
Yes, we sat by each other on the bus. Isla and I, neither of us slept the night before. And then we didn't even sleep on the bus trip down to D.C. because we were both so excited. And I don't think we even slept on the way back, did we, Isla?
I think maybe about 30 minutes.
Yeah, each of us.
Yeah.
And it was just, it was so cool to hang out with Isla for the day. I mean, that to me was priceless, just to be with her throughout the day and watch her as, you know, she was welcomed. I mean, there are people at the first stop was the World War II Memorial, and there are people in D.C. that gather there to welcome the World War II veterans. It was just so cool to see her experience that.
Isla, did you enjoy the adoring public?
Yeah, and we were really treated very specially because, well, they wanted pictures. They'll have to go home and get rid of them, but they
no.
They thought it was pretty special, and I did too. I loved the whole thing.
So you mentioned the World War II Memorial. What else was on the agenda?
The Lincoln Memorial, the...
She wanted to walk up the steps at the Lincoln Memorial, by the way.
Did you make it up?
We didn't let her.
But we got right up to it.
I didn't know there was a Navy Memorial, and that was towards the beginning of the trip, and I was really impressed with the Navy Memorial. Very nice. And did you see that, Isla?
Yes. Oh, yes. I had seen it before, too.
Oh, okay. I was really impressed with that.
Yeah.
And sometimes when we have more time, the museum is right next to the Navy. And I didn't know that existed either until one of the trips we made. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of cool.
Another one that they miss is the Women in the Military Service of America. They don't know it's there, I think.
That's why we're kind of looking at, hopefully, maybe someday down the road, an all-female trip and include the WIMSA, because they will meet us and give us a special tour and everything. I know what it's about, and it's really special for the women to show up.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Megan Harris, and we're talking to organizers and participants behind Honor Flight Pittsburgh. It's a free one-day out-and-back trip to Washington, D.C., where veterans from World War II, Korea, and the Vietnam era get to safely visit their own memorials alongside others who've served. Vicki, I have questions for you. You attended in April one of four women on your trip, all who served in the Women's Army Corps during Vietnam. You continued to serve in the National Guard until 2005, so that's 31 years in service total. What did it mean to you to share this trip with other veterans?
It was nice to be there and meet some of the World War II veterans and see how many of them are still alive. That's what's nice. When I found out there was four women, and I figured they'd be from different branches of service, so I was really surprised that all four were from the Women's Army Corps. And so we all exchanged stories and everything, and that was kind of nice to meet up with some of the ladies. None of us served together, but we all served back in the 60s, so that was nice.
Isla, I read about your time in service with the Navy from an account that you penned yourself in 2012 for the Veterans Voices of Pittsburgh. We'll have a link to that piece online, but in it, you write about boot camp in New York and performing at Yankee Stadium, that the friendships you made during those years really remain dear to you, even decades later. How did Honor Flight bring back some of those memories?
I did exchange Christmas cards and notes for many years, and each year, one more was off the list. And there were about six or seven of us that did this. And so far as I know, I'm the only one left. But we did correspond for years, and we'd go to conventions. We had a lot of conventions, actually. And we would always meet, and you'd take up right where you left off. You just felt so friendly and familiar, and just like you knew each other so well. Mm-hmm. And I miss that. because we just did it all the time.
Does that camaraderie extend to your experience in organizations like Honor Flight or others where you're able to, you know, share time and memories with other veterans, other people who've served?
Oh, yes. Yes, I've gained a lot of friendships with Women's Overseas Service League. And the flight was just great. I just was so happy to be a part of it. And the people on it were all terrific. There were, I think, about 5 women that went on this one. And I've always treated it extra special because I was a World War II veteran. And it doesn't mean that much to me. I'm just one of them.
It means a lot to the ones that came behind you.
Absolutely.
Yeah, they always tell me that. But I don't feel that anything special. I was just so happy that I did go in. I've felt that all through the years.
Vicki, does that sound familiar?
I was just thinking that we kind of have a joke amongst us women that we all follow Isla because she's so popular. Everywhere we go, she seems to, people gravitate to her. She's got such a personality, and she keeps, like she says, she doesn't think it's anything special, but we do. We think she's a special person.
You bet.
Well,
she has a great spirit. There's something just magnetic about Isla.
Oh, you're so kind.
So, Bob, Beth, you both attended the trips in April with Isla and later this year with Vicki. What is your favorite part of being a part of this trip time and time again?
I do a program. It's called Honoring Yesterday's Heroes.
Mm-hmm.
And I take pictures. We solicit this through the website, people that might have had relatives that have passed away that have served. And we do a special presentation. We take a picture at their memorial. We frame it, and then we give it to the family when we return. And that's probably one of the things that I enjoy the most. And I probably the thing that has kept me hanging in with Honor Flight is being able to do that and meeting a lot of special people. You know, you have that brotherhood and sisterhood that if you haven't served, you don't understand it. And this makes you understand it more. It's special. It really is.
Yeah. And Beth, we should mention there are a lot of treats and things that happen along the way that are more spontaneous, but also a few surprises for our veterans as well. If someone wants to get involved or feels like this is something that they want to participate in as a volunteer, or they're a veteran and just want to come along, how can they get in touch?
You can go to our website, honorflightpittsburgh.org, and sign up right there. And we would love to have any volunteers on any level, whether you're a veteran or not. We would love to have your help. And it really is a priceless experience. I mean, the bond I've built with Isla, I've talked to her on the phone since our trip on October 12th. She answers the phone, "Hello, Beth." Like, she looks at the caller ID and knows it's me. And, you know, my first trip I went on, I had a World War II veteran who served at Okinawa. I mean, it's priceless to have these experiences as a non-veteran and to have the honor of spending the day with them.
What do you say, Isla, Vicki? Would you two recommend the experience?
Oh, I would highly recommend it. And
to anybody.
I keep telling people that are veterans, oh, you have to do it. There are surprises all day long, and you will never forget your Honor Flight trip.
Applications are now open for Honor Flight Pittsburgh's 2020 trip season. We'll have links to those applications and ways to get involved on our website at WESA.FM. Beth Ruschel is the fundraising chair on Honor Flight Pittsburgh's local board of directors. Veteran Bob Kunkel previously served as well. Thank you both for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you, Megan.
Isla Cole is a Navy Waves veteran of World War II, and Vicki Hajduk served with the Women's Army Corps and Army National Guard for more than 30 years. Ladies, thank you so much for coming today. Thank you for your service to your fellow veterans and to the USA.
You're welcome. Glad to be here.
Happy to be here.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time on The Confluence, he's one of the exonerated five, and he's dedicated his life to helping the wrongfully accused reclaim their power and get out of prison. Hear from activist Dr. Yusuf Salam in town tomorrow to celebrate 10 years of the Pennsylvania Innocence Project. Plus, County Executive Ritz Fitzgerald joins us on the heels of winning his third and final term in office. If you missed anything from today's program or you'd like to catch up on past shows, please visit wesa.fm/confluence or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. I'm Megan Harris, the editor and producer of The Confluence. Kevin Gavin will be back with you tomorrow. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.